By now, you've probably heard about Linux, but whether you're a pro or have barely heard the word, Scale, the Southern California Linux Expo has something for you. Scale 6X will have over 50 speakers covering the hottest topics in open source software and more than 75 booths this year representing a wide range of commercial products and nonprofit organizations. Don't forget Friday's special sessions with Docs, open source software in the healthcare industry, the Women in Open Source Conference, and new this year is the Open Source Software in Education Conference. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2008 at the Westin LAX Hotel in Los Angeles, California. For more information and to register for the expo, visit socallinuxexpo.org, use promo code CAST, that's C-A-S-T, for 40% off of your registration. We'll see you at Scale.
The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology, and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show. This is episode 231, February 6, 2008. How's everybody?
All right. You know who I haven't noticed in the IRC chat in a long time? Is Mrs.
Who's that?
Mrs. Verbal.
Oh, those guys, they've moved on. They're on toilet shows now.
No, Verbal's there, but not Mrs. Verbal.
She's moved on.
They were on television shows now?
They're everywhere, those two.
But not Mrs. Verbal, she's not on our IRC anymore. I think she hates us.
What show hasn't Verbal been on? I can't think of many.
I don't have to, has he been on Linux Outlaws?
I think he has, yeah.
What about a Productive Linux Podcast?
I don't know about that one. I haven't listened to
the
many of
those. The Czarist podcast. He's slipping.
I know
he's slacking.
I know he's on Going Linux. I've heard him on. Of course, Linux Reality. He's on all of them. He goes around, man.
He's trying to say that she's there, but I don't see her. All I see is Verbal there. Verbal with a tail.
Verbal goes and volunteers to go do the time index for the Linux Basement podcast. But he doesn't offer for us.
That's it. I'm going to kick him from the chat. Hold on.
He's about to get booted.
I wouldn't do that. Who did I kick from the chat that one time? Oh, that was Rignes. That's right. Rhines. That's right. I think I kicked him from the chat. He's like, why'd you kick me? And I'm like, I don't know. It was fun.
Because he could.
Power went to my head, baby. Oh, Pat, you got some good news this week, right?
I can't believe it's not butter.
That's not what I meant.
Yeah, I got the OpenMoco test phone. It's now, this is the old version, the GTA 01 whatever. I think it's version 04. It's not the new free runner version that's coming out in a couple months, so it's the old version. This one doesn't have built-in Wi-Fi, but doesn't have 3D acceleration. This is the developer platform that they're still selling, I believe. And what the object was, we had the discussion with Michael Shilo from the OpenMoco project. The issue was that the phone only is able to do three bands at once, and the original version that they had wasn't able to do 850 megahertz, which is fairly common in rural areas of parts of North America. outside of urban areas. So what they did was they took one of the older phones and they modified it to work on 850 megahertz. And they set up a test plan and people volunteered to test the phone out in different areas. So I put added myself to the list and I got the phone on Monday. And I slapped my my SIM chip in there from AT&T, who's my current cell phone provider. And powered it up, and lo and behold, it connected right to the AT&T network without issue. And able to make outgoing calls, I'm able to get incoming calls, do SMS messages, it works pretty much.
But not browse the web?
You can, if you have it hooked up to your workstation through the USB cable, you're able to do Ethernet over USB. So you can do it that way. You just got to go in and set up your network configuration.
Is that the only way to do it?
I believe if you have a data plan, you can also do it also, but I don't have a data plan anymore.
Why not?
Because it's more money, and I'm a cheapo.
Tell your wife to let you get a data plan so you can test. How are you going to test it out without a data plan? I'm disappointed.
Well, I tested out the other things. I mean, it's
only
it's
$10 a month.
Does it have Wi-Fi?
This one, no. This version does not. Now, I gave Dan a call the other day. How was the audio quality there when I called you?
The audio quality was decent. The only problem I had with it was the odd thing about it was when I could hear my voice echoing back.
Yeah, and you know what, though? 850 megahertz is not as high of a quality as the 1900 band, I believe. It's a little older. But it works okay.
Oh, yeah, it was great, though. I mean, I would love to have one of those.
One of the things that it has in there, besides popping in a SIM card from your cell phone provider, it has a spot for a micro SD card. So I had picked one up not too long ago when I picked up my new camera. And micro SD cards are very common in smartphones. So that
and Nokia 770s.
Yeah, same kind of deal. And, you can put media on there. So what I did was I created a folder with media files on it. I put some AUGs and MP3s and a couple of video files. And I tried playing them in the media player. That's the NopaMoco. And the MP3 files played perfectly, no glitches. The AUG files sounded okay for the most part, but they were like every once in a while there were slight lags, like for like a split second. And I wonder if that's the case is because, AUG is more CPU intensive than MP3.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, and this version has only got a 233 megahertz processor in there. The newer one that's coming out, I think it's going to be 400 or 500 megahertz. So it's a much more souped up processor. I was playing with the contact manager. It's pretty easy to go in and make entries. You can put names, description, email addresses, phone numbers. If you get a call from someone who's in your contact book, the contact name comes up besides the phone number. There's a calendaring application where you can go in and put meetings and different items for you on your calendar for you. What else is in there? There's a bunch of games that you can play with. The coolest thing to me is you power it up and you see like a little Linux boot up. You see like the whole thing, the whole process going, scrolling through the screen. The boot up process is not very quick. It takes about, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 seconds. Supposedly that's going to improve with the newer version. The version of the OpenMoco that's on there, I think it's a few months old. It's from, I think the version that's on there is from like last September, I think. So it's not the latest and greatest firmware of OpenMoco. So everything is not up to date. Now, he just did his interested in testing the 850 megahertz modification, so the other stuff is not as important. It does recharge the battery via the USB cable, so as long as you keep it plugged into the computer with the USB cable, it will charge. They say the battery life is about, 5-6 hours if you power it down. There was an issue with sleep mode, I was reading, and it not waking up correctly, and I don't know if that's been resolved as of yet. What else? It's a pretty small phone. It's pretty light. Fits in your pocket pretty easily. The screen is a pretty nice size. I tried playing the video file. It was just a regular height, not a high definition, but standard definition DivX file, and it would not play. So I'm going to try playing around with maybe some other codecs and different resolutions, you know, much lower. Maybe something, you know, that we know plays in a Nokia. Maybe I'll try one of those.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Unfortunately, I only have the phone for a couple more days, and I got to send it up to the next person on the testing list. But
they gave you a deadline?
Cool. I'm going to try it. No, they didn't give me a deadline, but he said, you know, keep it for about a week and send it off. So our LUG meeting is this weekend. I'm probably going to bring it to that, and then after that I'm going to send it out.
Yeah, where's that going to or I'll get to you offline, but where's that going to be?
I think it's going to be at the Wegmans.
In Pat's basement.
Okay, we got to change the web page.
So I'll probably do that. I wouldn't mind doing that at some point. You guys are welcome to come by.
The dirty
just
got to
pick a good weekend. Now, my basement's nice
and clean. In Pat's manhole. I mean, wait.
You can come see the shrine to Steve Jobs.
Wrong day. Hey, did that problem you have with the address book, not importing your address or not reading your address book? Sorry. Go ahead.
What it was is my address book in my phone. It's not on the SIM chip. It's in the phone.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense then. Yeah, I hate that though, because you can't switch. You know, if you switch, it doesn't copy over. Your address stuff, you have.
What do you mean switch? Switch phones?
No, if my phone, you can switch it to either save it on the phone or save it on the SIM card. But if you switch, like if you have your address book on the phone and you switch to save it on the SIM card, it won't copy your address book over.
Right.
So you have to do it manually. You have to reinsert all the addresses, and I would assume that if you went the other way, it would do that too.
Now this thing has Bluetooth.
What?
I thought my Razer, I could actually store the address book on the SIM card.
No, you can't.
Some of them let you do that.
You should have a choice. But if you, by default, I think it's on the phone. And if you have your address book, like stuff in there, and you decide, well, I want to switch over to the, put it on the SIM card, it won't copy. You have to do it yourself, you know, re-put in all the addresses or whatever you need to do to get
it. Yeah, that's true. I think that's what it does on mine, yeah. Which sucks, but.
Sorry, Pat.
Yeah, with my Motorola, I was able to sync it via Bluetooth.
Sorry.
And I was able to pull down my contact information to my PC using K-Mobile Tools application. So I know that'll work, but I don't think that's not going to work with the OpenMoco under OpenMoco. And that might work under Qtopia. Now, Qtopia is the other framework. That's from the Trolltech people. Supposedly what you're able to do is put an image of Qtopia on the microSD card, and then go in and make an entry on the bootloader. It uses U-Boot, which is a very common embedded bootloader. And you can make an entry on there to go check your SD card to see if there's an image that you can boot from. So I'm definitely going to try that before I send it out. I want to see if I can get Qtopia working on it. That would be very cool. Because I hear that Qtopia is more mature than OpenMoco, and there's more applications available, and it seems to work a little better. So I'm pretty impressed with it for like a first, you know, first release that's purely a developer release. It's pretty good. I was showing some people at work, and they seem pretty impressed with it. Dan, when I talked, I mentioned that there wasn't an audio connection. There is an audio connection. I found it.
Where is it?
There's a little plug cover. It's on the side. There's a little plug cover in it. But the thing is, it's not a standard audio jack. It's a size that you use on, like, cell phones. It's a little bit smaller.
Oh.
So, you know, if you want to use a standard headphone jack, you got to get a converter plug, which you could probably pick up a Radio Shack for a couple bucks.
Does it have one of those, like, the coverings that you have to pull out? And it's not attached?
No.
Oh, does it have a covering at all?
No, this one doesn't. No,
this is not
a new phone. This is an older phone that's been modified, so I don't know. I don't know what they give you when you actually buy from them. So now this one was selling for $300. I was looking on the wiki, and they're saying that the next release is going to be $450. I don't know. It's kind of expensive, you think, but if you compare it with other smartphones like the Nokia, what's the big Nokia one, the N62, or some of the other ones that run Windows CE, they're expensive. They're like, you know, $400, $500, $600. The smartphones are pretty expensive, not cheap. And the cool thing with this thing is, you know, you can pretty much run it on any GSM network. And you're not tied to any provider. If you have a data plan, you can use the data plan to use the web browser and the RSS feeds and your email. So one cool thing is you're able to SSH into the phone. As long as you have it, the USB cable hooked up, you can SSH into the phone and poke around the file structure. It's
and
really
recompile
is a full
the kernel.
Blown, if you want to. It's a full-blown Linux environment. It's pretty impressive, I have to say. You know, you go in there and you look at the directory structure and what's on there. It's a pretty powerful little device, you know, even though it's only 233 megahertz. I mean, you think, you know that's not very powerful, but, you know, going back a few years, that was a pretty standard, you know, CPU configuration. Go back, like 6, 7 years, 8 years? So the new one is I think, double the processing power, so it should be interesting. Now, the interview that we got tonight, we got Rosterman, Carson Heitzler, who everybody knows from the Alignment Project, but he's now working for the OpenMoco project. He's doing all the GUI interfaces. So if people like Alignment, they might be interested to see what changes come in the interface of the OpenMoco project in the next few releases. So it's a pretty cool device, man. I'm pretty impressed with it.
It's taking a significantly longer time for this device to come out in the United States, and I hear that iRiver was showing off a Linux-based phone at CNET, CES this year?
CES. They actually have a phone that's like almost identical to the iPhone. And there's a couple other ones, too, that are like, they're such complete rip-offs of what Apple's doing to the iPhone. I mean, the applications look the same, the interface looks the same. You know, what are the things that in the interview that you're going to hear, Rosterman says, you know, he wants to do a complete 180, what everybody else is doing. And I think that's a good way to go about
it. A completely command-line-driven phone?
No, not command-line-driven, but we shouldn't be copying what other people are doing. I mean, I agree with that. On the desktop and in mobile devices, I don't think we should be following what everybody else is doing. I think, you know, Linux needs to innovate and stand on its own and show up as a viable alternative that's new and different and refreshing. We shouldn't, you know, be just copying everybody and chasing what everybody else was doing one or two releases back, you know?
So what we need to do is we need to get command line driven phone that instead of using the networks does the, you just cast out a string and it's like two cups on the end.
That'll work, yeah.
Nobody's
two
doing
cups,
that.
One string.
Another cool thing is it's got a little it's got a little terminal application, so you know you could fire up the terminal, and you can SSH into different devices. Very cool.
That's cool.
Yeah, it has a little on-screen keyboard, but it's so tiny. You really need like a pen or a stylus to pop out the keys. They're so small.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, it's tiny. You can't do it with your fingers.
It doesn't do that. Like, did you ever see an iPhone? How that keyboard works?
Yes.
It doesn't.
Yes, I played around with the iPhone at the AT&T store over here.
It doesn't do like the same type of effect that the iPhone does to make it easier to tap out.
Well, it depends on what application you're using. For instance, if you're using the dialer, it has the big buttons, you know, on the touch screen. That's pretty similar to what the Apple does. Like, if you go into like the application menu where you can pull everything up. It's like a little dragon. You put your finger on it, and you like slide it up or slide it down, and you'll see the move. You'll see the menu listing scrolling up or down, and then you double tap the entry that you want to, which application you want to fire up, and then you can go to the top corner from any application and tap it, and you'll get like a menu of active applications, or you can go back to the main menu. Also, some of the applications have like a common set of interfaces where on the bottom portion of the screen there'll be like three different tabs where you can go back to the main menu.
How, size-wise, you know, just looking at the size, the feel, how does it compare to the iPhone?
It's pretty close. Length-wise, it's maybe 4.5 inches, maybe, and wide, it's maybe 2 inches wide. The thickness is maybe 0.5 inch. I mean, it's small enough where you can put it in your pocket, and it doesn't bother you.
Okay. So, if you don't use if using the onboard the on display keyboard is difficult, what would you use in place of that? An external keyboard?
I mean, you can get a Bluetooth keyboard.
I'd hate to have to whip out a Bluetooth keyboard every time I want to use the machine.
Well, there's no slide-out tray with a keyboard on it. If you want something like that, maybe you should go get the Nokia N810.
I would be interested to know how well that would actually run with something like a... You know, I'm wondering about that. If you get something with a Wi-Fi connectability, and you can just make... And you can put, like, a soft phone on there and hook it up with your Astra.
You can.
Server.
That is happening, actually, Dan.
That'd be
if you
strange.
Read up... If you go to the OpenMoco mailing list, on a community mailing list... there's a guy talking about he's porting over some SIP phones, and he says he's got it working with Asterisk. So that is definitely in the pipeline, and that's going to happen sooner than later. And, yeah, that would be a great thing. You would be able to save quite a bit on a phone bill. If you're in a Wi-Fi area, you just, you know, fire up a SIP phone and connect to your Asterisk server and make a phone call that way, that's pretty damn cool.
Sweetness.
Sweet.
That's too bad you can't give it back, huh?
Yeah, I wish I could have it for a little longer. A week is not enough.
Do they give you a projected date as to when is it going to be available in the United States?
They say the springtime, early summer, so maybe May, June, July, somewhere in that range.
When are we supposed to see the iRiver phones?
Those are probably coming out sooner than later.
Oh, that helps. That was not vague enough.
I can't help you. If you want to contact someone from iRiver, please go ahead and do so.
No, I want you to contact someone from iRiver.
I don't know anybody at iRiver. You're the ones with the iRivers.
No, Alan's the one with the iRiver. Wait, do you still have an iRiver, Alan?
Somewhere in the mess that's on my desk, I think there still is one, yes.
So
I haven't used it in quite a long time.
It's a vital piece of your multimedia enjoyment.
Yes, everything is vital, but... Many things get lost. It's like this constant flow that just sort of like moves across the desk from one side to the other. Depending on where they are on the desk is how important they happen to be right now. So.
Well, it's a cool little device, man. And you don't have to worry about the provider doing a firmware upgrade that will break any changes that you've made to the system.
Well, that's because, you know, on all honesty, that provider you're talking about, there was no need to make changes to the system. It's already perfect. So you actually broke perfection when you made your changes.
I see.
That was the problem.
Speaking of perfection, did you hear Linus Torvalds' comments about the Apple file system? He didn't particularly care for it.
I did not engage too much in the forum posting on that and read anything about it other than the brief stuff I was just looking at a few minutes ago and a few days ago. So all I know is what was paraphrased and cobbled together from those postings. But if you'd like to elaborate, please, by all means, enlighten.
He doesn't like the file system.
No, I kind of got that at, you know, just from reading the...
And then he goes on to criticize Apple and Microsoft, talking about tie-ins and, you know, giving people a taste and forcing them to upgrade and upgrade your hardware so that, you know, you can run the operating system and they upgrade the operating system so that you have to upgrade your hardware. It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah. It is. And I forget who I was talking to, and I think it was on one of the IRC channels, and I don't know if it was us. We were talking about the upgrading Apple's OS and buying a copy of like Apple's operating system in the store, and I said that all the copies that you buy are upgrades. Apple doesn't sell their OS in the store. They sell the upgrade, which is essentially, you know, when it boils down to it, is the full version, you know, the full version anyhow. But you don't buy, like, because I think it was on the forum, wasn't it? That topic thread was going back and forth. Because the guy on the forum was looking at his son was in a research group and it required him to run and purchase an Apple to run OS 10 for their software, and he was interested in seeing whether he can get it to run on cheaper hardware. And then there's that OS x86 project or whatever it is, and there's a back and forth about that
What is that?
That is a song playing on the phone.
Oh, okay, so... Anyway, for whatever that tangent was, Pat wants to show off his phone instead.
Not my phone, unfortunately.
That's the way it goes. But, you know, you would think that with Apple controlling both the hardware and the software, they better put out some damn good products that integrate with one another flawlessly.
Well, how many desktops do they have? Three, four, two, three, something like that? And how many laptops do they actually have? Two, three?
Well, it's pretty much, you know, the same, almost the same technologies across all this. I mean, what, a better processor, a little more RAM, a bigger hard drive? I mean, essentially, the chipset is the same for all of them, isn't it? There's not much.
I don't know. I'm not an Apple user, so you have to ask somebody who is.
And they say there isn't much variety in their hardware. Therefore, you know, they should have it nailed down perfectly. There shouldn't be any, you know, of course, there's always going to be bugs, but that should. But, you know, you notice that, though. Their products work fantastic within their own little group of hardware and software, but you try and integrate other systems, man. Yeah, they don't play that nicely.
Hold on a second. I got to change the channel, man. U.S. is playing Mexico on ESPN, too. I got to change it. Hold on.
Got to change the channel.
Wait, why do I have to hold on while you change the channel?
I was going to say, he's across from the TV. You just get the remote there.
Yeah, don't you have a remote? He's got a TV with like one of those rotary channel changers on it. It's got one through, no, 2 through like 13 and U. 2 through 12 and U.
He's got like a 50-inch flat screen down there.
What's that?
Didn't you got a remote for that thing?
Yeah, but I only have crappy remote down here that comes with the cable box. That thing sucks.
Well, you're only turning channels.
Yeah, I put ESPN 2 HD to watch the U.S. versus Mexico game. That should be a good one.
Oh, you know what? I was just looking at the IRC. There's been mention of the big-ass analog clock. And it's disturbing because somebody posted a screenshot of the long-term support of Ubuntu coming up. What is that? 4.04.08? Is that it? Is that when it's coming up? 8.04?
Yes.
Yeah,
804.
And if you drop down the calendar up in the upper right-hand corner, it's got, like, little analog clocks on there. Come on! Do we need analog clocks? Can't they just be digital?
Some people have to learn how to tell time, Dan.
The OpenMoco does have a clock, but it's the digital one. It's the default one. The big-ass analog clock is not on there by default. But there are big-ass analog clocks that you can put on there if you want. If your heart desires.
I don't. You should know how to tell time. You shouldn't, by this time, you know, by this age, you shouldn't have to rely on a computer to make you learn how to tell time. I want speed and efficiency, and an analog clock isn't, I don't agree with that design. But, you know.
It'll work for you.
Maybe that's why I'm not designing user interfaces. But I'll still rally against them. I don't like the big-ass analog clock.
Dan, I would never have guessed.
Comes as a shock and a surprise, doesn't it?
Everyone is going to send you big-ass analog clocks now.
Yeah.
Here, I'll
send them care of the tech show.
I'll put a couple of big-ass analog clocks on the RC for on the OpenMoco. The first one I'm putting up there is a big-ass analog clock in Kitopia. And then let me find a big-ass analog clock with the OpenMoco, which is the GTK version.
Dun-dun-dun! Let's see what that looks like. Oh, boy. Yeah. Oh, man, that's horrible because the color scheme on that makes it difficult to discern some of the numbers, especially if you're red-green colorblind.
Well, the green stuff is Kitopia. The OpenMoco is like more like orange brownie kind of color.
Orange brownies. Dun, dun, dun. Speaking of that, Girl Scout cookies. Woo! They're out in droves these days. Holy mackerel.
We got some.
They're hitting everybody up. You go to Walmart, they're out there ringing where the bell ringers are, trying to get you to buy cookies. You got your work friends trying to get you to buy cookies from their daughters. You got your daughter's friends at school trying to be at
I know.
Everybody's trying to get you to buy
it's
cookies.
It's an assault, man.
And they're not as big as they used to be.
They're damn expensive.
They're expensive and smaller.
That's a good cause, but man, oh man. I don't know. Good thing it only happens like two or three times a year, right? And on top of that, then the school districts are always trying to get you to get the kids to donate or, you know, like, I don't know. The school down here does this really funky thing. They trick you. You know how, like, the PTA is a great organization. Don't get me wrong. But they have PTA meetings, and that's great and wonderful. But what the school down here does is they trick you. They have, like, a little assembly or something going on with the kids, right? So you go to watch your kid in, like, a choral assembly or some fun thing like that. And then before the actual assembly, they have this, like, mini PTA meeting, and you have to sit there and listen through it, and you're like, oh god, couldn't they just send out like an email newsletter to explain this stuff? You know, and then they try and get you to sign up for different projects and do different PTA things, and it's like, come on, I'm not here for the PTA meeting. I'm here to watch my daughter, and then I want to go home. But I don't get me
Learn
wrong
to go
I respect
late.
The PTA, yeah. But then you get a crappy seat all the way in the back. And you have to stand through the whole thing.
Children, there's the trade-offs you got to do there, Dan.
I'm waiting for that other clock posting from Pat.
Let me go find it.
Oh, I thought you were posting both of them.
I didn't have them sitting ready to go for you.
Yeah, you do, Dan. It's like get like a handicap thing, like one of those like flexible casts. That way, even if you get there late, they'll seat you up front.
Or come in a wheelchair.
That works too, yeah.
Come in a wheelchair and then walk out after it's all done.
My God, it's a miracle. I can walk again.
Oh, that's terrible.
You guys are evil, man.
Yeah, not evil.
Yes, you are. You're evil.
You know what I did for the first time today, Pat?
What'd you do?
I actually sat down and I started playing around with Keno. Actually, I should say, not just today, but last night. And I pulled up, you know, I had some video project I was working on a little while ago. And I threw some more video in there and I'm like, well, you know, let's see if I can import this. So I imported an MPEG file and that worked great. I mean, I was surprised. I remember back in the past, Keno would only get just like digital video and certain AVIs. But it's now the import feature is a whole lot better. You know, it was great. So I put together a little DVD and exported it, and then I played it over here for my family. It didn't have any chapters or anything. It was just a quick jalopy there, but it was really easy. So I guess I need to use that in conjunction with QDVD Author to get a nice DVD with chapters and menus and everything.
That'll definitely help.
Now, do you... When you did that with Kino and QDVD Author, did you export the videos in QDVD?
I've done it both ways. In Kino, if you export the videos, you can do it a couple different ways. You can make it like a standalone MPEG-2 file or some other codec, or you can create an actual DVD inside of Kino. There's an export functionality.
Right.
And what it is, it'll create a DVD, it'll create the whole file structure. It just won't have any, like, menuing or anything. All it'll have will have timestamps. That's it.
And then you
Which
just,
is fine. For,
yeah, do you just import that into a... Can you import that into QDVD Author or what?
Well, it depends what you want to do. If you wanted to just a standalone video file, you could import it into QDVD Author or some other DVD Author and application. It works fine. Or you can, you know, just do a quick and dirty DVD out through Kino through an export.
So if I do like one Bulldog MPEG-2 file and pull it into the QDVD Author, will that allow me to make menus and kind of chop it up?
Sure.
Or do I have to? Or would it be better to export the videos like the chapters that I want individually and pull those into the
QDVD? You could do it either way. I mean, you can create one big chunk video file, and in QDVAuthor you can put the chapter indexes in there.
So
there's all different ways of doing it, you know. So a lot of times, if you have like a bunch of different video clips, you want to just create a DVD. You go into QDVAuthor or one of the other applications, and you just import the videos and put them in whatever order you want, and set the indexes, you know, in between the clips.
I'm gonna have to do that. I'm gonna have to play around with it.
Try both ways. People like doing it different ways.
I mean, I really like Kino's pretty damn easy to use, and the export DVD was perfect, but it doesn't.
It's
have
easy
chapters.
For quick and dirty. Kino's great, man. If you want to do like home videos and stuff, Kino's fine. It's when you get into the fancier, more complicated type stuff that, you know, you start to see the limitations of it. I've been starting to get Acadian Live, and that's a little more heavy duty.
What are you running Acadian Live on?
On my workstation here.
Which is running what distro?
I'm running Kubuntu on AMD 64.
Now, does Kubuntu have the packages for it, or did you have to compile that yourself?
No, the Ubuntu repositories have it.
Oh, and is it stable now?
It's fairly stable, yeah. It's more stable than, say, Cinelara is.
What's your opinion of it? I mean, you said it's a little...
It's coming along quite nicely. The last couple of versions have been pretty stable. It's getting there.
Wait, didn't Dan Dennedy say he's dropping Kino and it should...
He's not doing any more development for it.
And he recommends go to Acadian Live?
Yeah, what it is he put some effort into MLT, which is his framework that he developed with a couple other people. And Acadian Live is one of the applications that uses that.
Right. So Acadian Live, it's how comparable is it to Kino and on a difficulty curve or ease of use?
It's a lot easier than, say, Cinelara is.
Okay, but it's not as easy as Kino?
It's comparable. It's maybe a slightly little more difficult.
What about transitions and stuff?
You can do that, yeah.
Now, how's the documentation for it? Because, I mean, Kino's documentation was pretty good.
It's okay. There's some articles out there that talk about it if you look around, and the website isn't horrible or anything.
Well, thanks for being a little ambiguous there, Pat, not coming down with a definitive review.
Well, actually, I've been playing around with it, and I'm working on an article for it, so...
Oh!
I'm waiting for the article to get the heavy-duty info.
Oh, who are you working writing the article for?
I'm going to try Linux Magazine, which is Linux Pro in the U.S. Now, speaking of Cinelara...
Wait, why don't you try Linux Format? They gave us a great review. I'm sure they'd love to have an article from you.
Actually, that wasn't Linux Format. Was it Linux Format?
Yeah, it was Linux Format.
I thought it was one of the... Well, Linux Format, okay. Speaking of Cinelara, they're having a fork. Did you hear about that?
Why?
What it is Cinelara is based on Heron Warrior?
Heron Warrior, yeah.
Heron Virtual Limited, which is supposedly a semi-commercial entity. And for the longest time, the community has maintained their own code base based off of the HV version. And they've come to a head and they've decided they want to rewrite some major stuff into it. So they're going to be breaking completely with the HV code base. There was an article on Linux.com. I'll post it in the RSC. You can check it out.
They want to rewrite it? I mean, there's not something they could like work together with the existing base? They have to fork it?
Apparently they've been trying to submit patches and enhancements to it, and the HV doesn't seem very interested in it. So they're saying, you know, enough is enough, we're just going to do our own thing.
Yeah, I mean, I know Aaron Newcomb really has gotten accustomed to Cinelara and has really enjoyed using that. I've just always found it such a... Man, that interface is not easy to get involved, you know, get accustomed to.
It's a little daunting when you first open it up and you see all these windows open up. You're like, what the hell is that? But you know what, though? A lot of these high-end applications are like that.
Oh, yeah.
The same thing with, say, Ardour. you fire up our door for the first time, you look at it, and you're like, what the frig? Where do I start, you know? Or, say, Blender, you know?
Oh, Blender.
They're heavy-duty, complicated applications, but they're super powerful. You know, there is a learning curve involved in learning how to use them, but once you learn them, you know, they're pretty usable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't fault them for being underpowered, man. It's just, I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say they're damn powerful stuff. I mean, it's the approachability and the documentation that I remember when I was playing around with it that was lacking. Anyway, what were you going to ask me, Pat?
I don't know. You want to play the interview?
Whenever you're ready. Unless
it's
Alan
about 55 minutes long, so.
All right, Alan, did you have something you wanted to add right now, or should we just play the interview?
No, we can play the interview.
Okay. I got to turn on my GP2X because that's what I'm playing it from today.
Don't forget to mute the mic, Dan.
I won't. And do you want to do any setup for this, Pat, or...
The interview is with Rasterman Karsten Heitzler, who is the main guy behind the Enlightenment Project, and he's now going to be working for OpenMoco Project. So the first half of the interview, we talk a lot about Enlightenment and what's in store with that and the different history about it and what the applications do. And then the second half, it's more geared towards OpenMoco and what he's doing over there.
Excellent. And this is 55 minutes long?
Yep.
And let me just double check the battery capacity on this thing. And it says I have a full battery charge, and these are new batteries in there as of today. So this thing should be at least good for another 4 or 5 hours.
Be good for another 10 minutes.
So when it cuts out in 5 minutes, ha ha! Yeah!
Just check it sporadically, Dan.
No, I will. I'll be here. Laughing at the people on the IRC. All right, everybody, this is the interview with Rasterman, and here we go.
Hi, this is Pat DeVille from the Linux Link Tech Show. I am with Karsten Heitzler, otherwise known as Rasterman of the Enlightenment Project. Karsten, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
It's a huge honor talking to you. A lot of people are big fans of the Enlightenment Project and all of that you've done. For people who don't know, could you give us a little background on the Enlightenment Project and how it started?
Enlightenment started a very long time ago, actually before GNOME, and give or take about the same time as KDE. It started back at the end of 1996, when basically I decided to replace my existing window manager with my own because I was getting tired of the limitations and being able to configure it. And it basically just grew from scratching an itch. It was never a project intended to attempt to change the world or, you know, push some sort of agenda. It was just, you know, I don't like this. I will fix it. I know that the system can do it. And it kind of has grown from there ever since. It's now pretty damn large as a project. It's CVS. Contains in the area of about 750,000 lines of C code. It's pushing on almost a million now.
Well, one of the things that gets me about Enlightenment is it's so different from any of their Linux-related window managers. It's as far as you can get from Windows. Was this by choice, or it just turned out that way?
That's more about me generally not wanting to toe the line. If someone does A, I generally like to do B. Simply because I don't want to be part of the I'm the same as everybody else crowd. If I want a Windows GUI, I will go use Windows. Why bother using Linux? It is to try something different, to be something different, to do the things everyone else is either afraid to do, doesn't have the time to do, or doesn't necessarily have the imagination to do. But at the same time, sometimes you hear people come up with great ideas elsewhere, and we'll adopt them, but invariably we don't adopt them verbatim. We kind of take them and completely twist them around to something of our own.
One of the really exciting things about Enlightenment is that it's lightweight, it's really fast, but visually it's pretty impressive for what you're doing. How do you strike that fine balance of being functional and pleasing aesthetically while still not getting too bloated?
you actually pay attention to optimizing your code when you write it, as opposed to, well, let's design a really big hulking system that can do this entire specification here and worry about optimization sometime in the future. But a lot of the back end of Enlightenment has been written just for Enlightenment. If you split out into separate libraries, it comes under the header of the ESL or Enlightenment Foundation libraries. And there are things like Evis and Edge and Ease and eCore. Each of them have a specific task to solve a problem and to solve it really efficiently. So, for example, Evis is the rendering core. It handles objects, visual objects on screen and how to render them. And its software rendering backend was like many years in the making. And it has been highly optimized to do exactly what it does. And it was not set down as a, we have to try and meet all this specification. Or what can we do? What can we do really efficiently and fast? And then let's make that happen. And actually sit down, profile, optimize, have benchmark test suites, from the very beginning to try and make sure it works that way. And at the end of the day, it pays off. So what you gain in terms of having made it efficient to start with gives you the ability to do really amazing, interesting things later, because now it is not so hard to do it anymore. It does not cost so much CPU.
Now, going from version 0.16, which has been around for quite some time now, going to 0.17, what are some of the really big improvements and changes that you've made?
Well, it's very hard to compare 0.16 and 0.17 because they're not the same window manager. There is not a single line of code in common. 0.17 was written from the very ground up, from scratch. There is nothing in common at all. We haven't even copied or borrowed any code from E6.10. So as such, it is basically a new window manager. So what is better? The theme system, which is basically driven by Edge, is by far and wide incredibly more powerful. In fact, I doubt you'll find any sort of theme engine or system anywhere in any GUI that is as powerful as Edge on any platform that includes Mac or Windows. In terms of being able to configure, the look and to some extent the feel of the user interface without having to go write actual code like C code, it is incredibly powerful. The only problem there is it's so powerful it actually takes a lot of effort to learn and get into. And that is possibly a major problem. But other than that, E17 is significantly more efficient in many internal ways. In terms of managing windows, handling their property changes. It is by far and wide more expensive than support of the free desktop.org standard. It is, unlike E16, it has a complete modular plugin system where you can extend and modify the window manager in all sorts of amazing ways just by plugging in a module. And these modules let you do anything from adding little gadgets on the screen to adding entire sections of user interface to modifying the layout policy of where windows get placed on screen and how they appear and disappear and everything else. Modules are incredibly powerful because they basically let you insert a piece of your own code into the window manager without having to patch the window manager itself. And there are a massive list of many other things. The only way to really, know the difference is try it and see what you like and see what you don't like.
No.
But overall, there is a massive list of major changes, a lot of them visual, from the theme system, animated backgrounds, animated cursors. Alpha blending is capable in, quite possible in many, many areas, etc.
Now, you talk about the modules that come with it. There's a default set of official modules. I'm sure there's third-party and community-contributed modules. Is there any process where these third-party modules might get included into the official release?
No, there is no process. there is a set of core modules which do exist. We do have a to-do list of things we want to do for E17. A few of those things are modules, which do happen to exist in the third-party modules, which is currently in Enlightenment CDS under the E-modules module. But we will import the code if and when, we need to. And only if the code and the module is at a quality level where we are willing to enforce into the main core. The problem generally with third-party modules is they tend to be of not as high level of quality because they're written by somebody who's new to the code, or they get written and used but then not maintained as the core code changes APIs and internals. The modules often don't tend to keep up as well. So it's just a question of time before whatever there gets rolled in. But in general, there is almost no benefit to rolling in modules unless they really are a core piece of functionality you really want or need for your desktop. We want to keep the modules outside of the code because they can be developed independently of the main code and maintained and released independently. If you roll them in, then they will become part of our release cycle and our maintenance, and the original authors and maintainers or users will not have a choice in that matter then, unfortunately. So the more they stay third party, the better it is for users.
Now, how far along is 017, and how long do you think it will take for it to be, you know, ready for official release? What needs to be done between now and then?
How far along? Well, a long way along, if we consider where it all started. Considering the window manner, E17 is larger as a code base than E16 by quite a margin, let alone all the libraries that were pretty much written specifically for it that make it several times bigger. So from that point of view, it is, you know, a very long way along. There are still major things to do. Some of the major items are the install wizard. So when you first run Enlightenment, it asks you a bunch of questions and set things up for you based on what kind of system you have. For example, it would go and detect if you have a battery, and if you do have a battery, ACPI or APM. It would then go, ooh, you have a laptop, and, you know, offer or a default sort of configuration that would be, you know, friendly to power management for a laptop, as an example. It would do things like do a bit of benchmarking to take a guess at how fast your machine is and configure some visual aspects based on benchmark numbers, ask you what language you want to have set up, and so on, etc. That has to be done. There are some other items, like cleanup of the default theme, and a whole bunch of small little things floating around. How long that will take? Unknown at this stage. We don't actually give release dates. It's done when it's done.
Now, you mentioned that 017 was almost a complete rewrite of what 016 was. Where do you start? Do you create build a whole library and toolkit from scratch? How do you go about this?
That's exactly what we did. We built the whole library and toolkit from scratch. Just started. And then just kept plodding along because I knew what would be needed as part of doing E16 and then doing a very old EFM, which was a file manager. It became more apparent, you know, every time I wrote something, that in the end I was rewriting and mimicking the same bit of code in multiple applications, and that creating a shared bit of code that could do all of that and abstract it would be worthwhile. And at the same time, being able to have a rendering system that was completely abstracted from its target rendering mechanisms. So, for example, the current rendering mechanism by default for E17 out of the box is software. That means all the graphics you see are rendered with your CPU. There is no graphics acceleration, you know, involved there. So it's raw CPU grunt that generates the visuals. But at the same time, it abstracts to things like XRender or OpenGL. It has an OpenGL engine, has an XRender engine, has DirectFB engines and a frame buffer and even a Windows Win32 and a DirectX engine, believe it or not. But that abstraction was put in there at the very beginning, designed to be a future-proofing mechanism of, well, XRender looks like it'll probably be the right way to go, and that can be accelerated by hardware if the X drivers do it. But at the moment, it is so horrendously slow, it is unusable as a rendering mechanism. So what we'll do is we'll put in a placeholder for this in the future. We'll put something in now that exercises that, but we'll use our software rendering code and wait till the actual hardware drivers and XRender is ready for us. And from an early stage, we were looking at those kind of abstractions, seeing where we'd have to go and layering them in. And at the end, it all paid off. It was, you know, pretty much the right direction to go, and we made the right choices from day zero. And, you know, we're just happy that we had done that.
How do you feel about some of the approaches some of the other desktops have done? For instance, with Kwin, with KDE 4.0, and also Compiz, it seems these guys are going more towards offloading a lot of the graphics to the GPU instead of going strictly with the computer CPU. But you guys take a completely different approach. How do you feel of what they're doing and how you guys stand?
Well, first of all, something like Compiz, if you do not have a relatively medium to high-level 3D accelerated chipset, you cannot even run it. So before you go anywhere, you've just vetoed the ability for it to run on lower end systems. Secondly, if you actually try and use it for a while on existing drivers, even NVIDIA drivers, which are some of the best 3D, you will find it to be quite unstable. On a regular basis, I test my own OpenGL engine, and I have my entire X server and system hang, you know, a couple of times a day, just because I'm exercising the OpenGL acceleration. So from that point of view, I would say that they're going down a very experimental path for drivers that are still unstable, untested, unready. They're limiting, if you're forcing, like Compiz does, compositing environment onto the user, that is then limiting them to having a high-end hardware choice, and to some extent limiting them on their driver choice as well. It also doesn't scale down. Kwin, on the other hand, has an optional extra, and so you don't have to do anything. Believe it or not, E17 has two modules already. It has a Bling and a Bang module. Bling uses XRender to do compositing, so there is a composite manager, and Bang is an OpenGL compositor for E17. It is not part of the core. We consider it still way too unstable, way too unreliable, and way too heavy to put in the core, and it's something we want to concentrate on in the future, but it's not ready at the moment, in our opinion. So as the KDE authors themselves even say, the compositing support in Kwin is an experimental feature. It is not a core feature you should rely on. If you read the actual, you know, the logs and the commit logs and the comments by the authors themselves. And I definitely agree with them on that. And from our point of view, when it's experimental, we're not putting it into the window manager core. It's a module. It's available to be plugged in if you want it, and it's maintained by a third party, but it is not part of the core. So we are just avoiding the problem until it works. At the same time, remember that Compiz and Kwin, they only exercise the composite extension, which means redirecting all rendering of windows to a bitmap, and then exercise the ability to composite those windows in an interesting way. They do not in any way or form modify how applications render the content of their window. So if you have a old-style FDL game, for example, like Myth 2 or Civilization, it will still render all of its contents with software. The only bit of hardware involved is taking the software content of that window and then compositing it on the screen later. So it's only partly using the hardware for specific special effects. We are not doing any special effects in that regard with the content of client windows. We completely ignore the content of client windows.
But Enlightenment still looks really fresh and different. One of the things that really stuck at me when I looked at it was some of the animated desktops where, depending on the time of day, it changes the scenery in the background. To me, that's really innovative and really different from whatever anybody else is different and what everybody else is doing. You know, you say that you want to take things in a fresh new direction. Is that part of it compared to what everybody else is doing with compositing?
Well, interestingly enough, having animated backgrounds is a pure byproduct of E17's theme engine. The fact that a theme engine is able to animate things based on timelines and input and output events, and time itself is an input source on its own, it's just a sheer byproduct of the development gone into the theme engine. So your desktop wallpaper is an element of a theme. When in Enlightenment you go and select a JPEG or a PNG or whatever for your desktop, it actually literally compiles a lump of theme binary blob on disk that uses the image you selected. And then the wallpaper is just another theme element like everything else. So it's piggybacking on the same back end that drives everything else. So again, like early decisions to make powerful engines and powerful back ends that can do this and do it efficiently, do it well, and be extended, has paid off in spades in others being able to take advantage of those hooks and those systems to do interesting things. The potential for all of this is barely tapped at the moment. Animated wallpapers is only the start. There's a lot of things that can be done that no one's even tried yet. So they're basically waiting on examples to let them go, wow, I can do that, and then they'll probably go do it. But they just have to wait for that. So we've more gone down that path of building that. The mechanism by which that gets to the screen, as I said, is already been abstracted. And we can use XRender, we can use OpenGL to do it. They are just not in a position to be used reliably to do it.
Now,
yet.
The Enlightenment Foundation libraries, which are used extensively in Lightning DR17, has anybody developed applications outside of the Enlightenment project using these libraries?
Yes, they have. I personally developed my own media center for it called Rage, and I use it at home for, you know, playing videos and so on. It happens to be an Enlightenment CBS, but it is not part of the project. It's just something I did to myself as a result of me being annoyed at living in Japan and not being able to find DVD players that will play DVDs from regions other than Japan. And being a Westerner in Japan, you tend to have a collection of DVDs that are not Japanese DVDs. So building your own PC to play your DVDs was part of that, and the media center basically became a mechanism by which to take my DVDs, rip them to disk as, you know, MP4 files, and store them on a big hard drive and play them from there, and just have a nice GUI to be able to do that. And there is another media center that's been written by a French guy called ENNA, Emma, that was also done separately. There is a home automation control system done by a bunch of French people. And they Canola, a multimedia, you know, video, audio, photo browser for the Nokia N800. That is written using EFL. I'm sure there's others that I've forgotten at the moment. The Frevo guys.
Oh, right.
The competitor to Myth TV, they're using Evis as well. They're using the EFL libraries as well to do their stuff. That's it that I can think of off the top of my head at the moment.
Now, that's interesting that Canola, which is used on the Nokia, is using those libraries. You recently switched jobs, correct? You're working on the OpenMocha project?
Correct.
What's your involvement with OpenMocha? What are you doing exactly?
I'm lead graphics architect, so if it involves pixels, it involves me.
That's great. So that means that we got some really good things to look forward to from OpenMocha then.
Yep, nothing yet, but just wait. That's why I don't have anything to say on that front at the moment.
Well, we're definitely going to be interested in what happens with OpenMocha. We had Michael Shilo on not too long ago, who is the community manager. And he really gave us a fantastic background and some really good insights on the project. And we're really looking forward to what comes with the OpenMocha project, and we're really pulling for it. So best of luck with your work on that.
Thank you very much.
Now also,
I'm also looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's really cool stuff, and I really can't wait to see how that turns out. Some other things. Back to Enlightenment. Who's doing most of the development besides yourself? Do you have other people working on it besides you?
Yes, there's in fact a whole development team. There's a lot of us. Unfortunately, it's a list that's way too big to keep in my head at all times. But there's about 20 or 30 people involved at any time, depending on what they're doing and so on. So as I said, the Canola guys in Brazil. Gustavo is their main contact there. They're relatively heavily involved. You'll find, Dan Sinclair and Nick Hugert and many, many, many people. It's a huge list. Do you want me to really start reading out the entire list?
No, you don't have to.
Sebastian.
You can give shout-outs.
Yeah, to put this way, it's... Yeah. On the Enlightenment.org page under contacts, if you want to look at the people involved, there is a massive, massive list of people. More than 20, 30, 40. I just started, picking names at random from what I had seen and talked about recently. It's a lot of people involved.
Now, have you guys actually physically gotten together at any point, or is it strictly done over the internet?
It's pretty much done over the internet. Every now and again, one or two of us gets to see one or two of the others at some sort of event, some sort of thing going on, either a conference or a trade show or whatever it is, but it's almost exclusively done over the internet.
Integration, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Sometimes if you're in the GNOME desktop, or you're in the KDE desktop, and you file up applications that are either not from the native desktop that you're using different toolkits, they don't integrate nicely. Have you guys done any work to try to make things a little more integrated looking rather than just slap together?
Well, basically, when you have an application and it opens a window, anything inside of that window is the application's thing, and there's nothing you can do about it. That's all under the control of the application. If the application happens to use the same toolkits and libraries as GNOME, then in those libraries they tend to tell people, well, if you write a GNOME application, you do it this way, you do it that way. And therefore it seems to integrate. But as such, once you're inside the borders of a window, underneath the title bar and all the stuff that's normally in the content of a window, that is outside the control of the window manager or the desktop as such, and is all in the control of the application process. So there's not much you can do beyond cross your fingers and go, I hope that the application programmers tend to do things that are right and sensible, and so they work.
Now, lately there's been a lot of big news with Enlightenment. This distribution GOS, which is being sold over here in the States through the Walmart store, seems to really have sparked an interest from people. It's a low-end machine that you're selling for like $200 U.S. It's using the GOS operating system, which uses Enlightenment. Were you contacted at all by those guys at all for any help or assistance or consultation or anything?
I was contacted as the beginning of the idea going, well, we want to do something, and GNOME and KDE are a little bit heavy on this. We want to have headroom to be able to do more interesting things, and at the same time, they didn't want to just be yet another distribution that's the same as everybody else, shipping exactly the same thing. So they didn't want to be an exact cookie cutter. And so they decided they wanted to do something a bit different, and they asked, and I didn't directly do anything, but what I did is I put them in touch with some of the community, the developers who are in the community, some of the people I mentioned and others I didn't even mention. And they basically formed a team themselves and did work for the GOS project. So that whenever X shipped their PCs, that it had what they wanted on it. So, yeah, I was vaguely involved from that point of view, but not directly as such.
Because it seems like lately Linux has really, really caught on the low-end market, especially devices such as the EEPC, the EverX machines being sold with GOS. It seems that it's found a niche and it's starting to take off. And one of the things that's really different about it is that it's using Enlightenment. Some of the reviews have been negative, some of them have been positive, but you really have to admire what they're trying to aim for. They're trying to find, a real niche audience, but it seems to be working. Have you been approached by any other distributions that are looking to make Enlightenment as part of their official desktop?
There are several smaller distributions wanting to use Enlightenment, and people creating new distributions just with Enlightenment on it at the moment. There was an old, fairly stale project for Lbuntu, which was an Enlightenment-based Ubuntu project, but effectively GOS has taken that over as being the primary. So there are a few people. A while ago, TerraSoft with Yellow Dog Linux shipped Enlightenment for the PlayStation 3. Again, the PlayStation 3 as such is a low-end CPU. The core CPU itself is not very fast. And unless you make full use of all the SPUs, the co-processors that are on it, it really doesn't perform that well. So you do have to go for something lower end. especially since you don't have a lot of memory on them. So they chose to go with Enlightenment as well, and they are quite happy with their decision.
And there's also GeoBuntu, which is an Ubuntu-based distribution that uses E17 with some different pieces of GNOME and XFCE, and I believe.
Yes, there's that one too. I lose track of, you know, all of them out there, because it's just too much to, you know, deal with all the email and code and everything else. So every now and again, one of these names filters through, and I hear about it, see it, and go, oh, cool, and you know, smile, and they can go back to doing their code.
Now obviously, you work a day job doing other things, so obviously, Enlightenment is a labor of love for you. How much time do you actually get to dedicate working on it on a daily or weekly basis?
That depends. In the past few years, I've honestly maybe found on average 1, 2, maybe 3 hours a day. So let's call it an average of 1 to 2 hours a day over the last few years. More recently, I've had more time in the area of like, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours a day. And to some extent, what I'm doing at the moment for OpenMoco is intersecting heavily with Enlightenment, so there's more time being there's more crossover there in terms of time. But in general, not a lot. So a reason for it being slow is the fact that at times it just will not have any work done on it for weeks on end. And then sometimes there's a bit of a burst, and then there's like little bits in between. Sometimes you get caught up in minor things when, you know, main code doesn't move forward because you're waiting for other stuff to finish, etc. So it's highly variable.
Well, let me ask you, what are some of the directions you guys want to go in, you know, that you haven't touched upon already? Is there anything that you'd like to do that's on your list of things that you want to do once things get closer to being done?
Well, not for E17, but for E18, compositing is definitely on the list. More extensive API hooks for modules to be able to modify E much more. The theme system, Edge, which is what drives the themes, will probably get heavily extended and made increasingly more powerful over time. Rendering-wise, definitely improvements in the rendering engine, more optimizations, faster, more efficient, more support for more rendering primitives. Did I cover E17 and positing? Yes. Improved user interface. As with all things, our current actual user interface dialogues and so on aren't exactly great. They're mostly, we have an actual option here, let's just push it up on the screen, let you have access to the option, and we're worried about making incredibly slick, ways of accessing, you know, configuration and stuff later. Other things we definitely are looking and wanting to do is online integration. For example, if you want to browse for a new wallpaper, instead of having to bring up your web browser, browse through a gazillion sites, download a wallpaper, go and select the wallpaper with your, you know, I want to select my wallpaper configuration dialog, and then finally have it, we actually want to integrate that in. In fact, recently, a guy has just submitted some patch to do exactly that, where there is a website wallpapers browsing dialog where literally it will parse an RSS feed from one or more websites, and it will give you all the wallpapers that are available to you to select it as if it's an extension of your own hard drive, but online. But definitely more online integration like that. Be able to submit your own wallpapers or themes or icon sets or anything else you want, modules in the end and so on. But one of the big ways where I definitely tend to go in the future is more embedded, more specific purpose things. So, for example, more applications that do things like media center applications and more support for those, more modules and extensions and hooks and Enlightenment to make it much more embedded friendly for specific purpose user interfaces. So, you know, one application at a time style phone or PDA interfaces and so on. That is going to be added and improved on over time.
We're working with embedded stuff. What's the different challenges that you might get than a regular desktop, besides making the code smaller and more optimized?
Actually, believe it or not, making the code smaller and more optimized is less of an issue, considering the level of optimization that's already there and what you get for the code that is there, it may be relatively heavy compared to some of the minimal manual window managers like Matchbox, but the feature list you get in return is absolutely immense. Anything with a comparable feature list is generally several times the size and with a lot more memory, CPU, and everything else, resource requirements attached to it. So in that regard, no, we don't have to do much, but what we do have to do is make it work better, for example, for really small screens. The screen on the Nokia N800 is 800 by 480, but it's only a 4-inch screen, or thereabouts. The screen on the OpenMoto, the Neo 1973, is a 2.8-inch screen, and it's VGA, 640 by 480. So when you display on those screens, you have to display a lot of pixels, and everything has to be very large, but it's actually physically very small. Also, a lot of these screens are going away from stylus-based input, which is very mouse-based, precise, so you can have small things on screen, to finger-based. Fingers are very large, fat, inaccurate, and they are, unlike styluses, convenient and very hard to lose. So having a finger-based UI where everything generally tends to be bigger or have more margin of error to allow fingers to drive it is definitely something we're looking at doing. And on top of that, just being able to fit useful information onto small screens and make it come up and disappear in nice, interesting, and useful ways is all on the list of things to do. So, you know, really smart virtual keyboards or other input methods that are similar, you know, better generic scrolling and application handling multiple applications at once in a really nice way on small screens, being able to extend those small screens from the device on, from a device that has the screen onto external screens plugged in, and so on, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, let me ask you, you're working on the graphics and the look and feel of the OpenMoko project. How much of an influence have you felt with some of the other embedded devices that are in the marketplace?
Right.
Have you looked at some of the other devices that are out there, and have they influenced you, in particular the iPhone? It seems that at the Consumer Electronics Show recently, there were a ton of, like, knockoffs of the iPhone. I mean...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have played with and looked at the iPhone, well, on the iPhone, iTouch, whatever. I have played with iPods. In fact, personally, I think that the iPod has possibly one of the worst user interfaces out there. It is incredibly hard to use. It takes a lot of menu browsing just to do some of the simplest things, like change to shuffle play or just to do simple things. Everyone's in love with it, but it is not really that great. The iPhone and iTouch is much better. It's got a lot of whiz-bang to it, but I'm very wary of copying it and mimicking it. As with Enlightenment, if people do A, I tend to go towards doing B. Mostly because I don't want to be a copycat. I don't want to be seen as, you know, the people who just copied somebody else and made a cheap knockoff. You know, if at the end of the day, if OpenMoko is a phone that, you know, looks and feels like the iPhone but happens to be built on Linux, I think we probably failed, because we haven't built anything unique and new. All we've done is copy somebody else's ideas. And next time Apple comes up with a great idea, that all we're doing is copying them again. What we need is a culture of people who think for themselves, who come up with great ideas on their own, and are busy defining the curve, defining the bleeding edge, defining what is great and what is all wonderful, not waiting for somebody else to do that for us.
It's kind of the same deal with the desktops. Like, it seems Linux fell into the whole trap of, you know, just chasing and copying what Windows is doing, chasing and copying what Mac is doing. You want to get completely away from that.
Yes. The idea being that, you know, I've seen lots of these devices. I've seen the Apple set of ones. I've seen a whole mountain of phones, from Qtopia Linux-based ones through to all the Symbian ones. I've seen the Windows and mobile ones. I've got a Nokia N800 myself. You know, but we should not just limit ourselves to that. Remember that you have things like the PSP, the Nintendo DS. They are legitimate user interface designs, you know, as well as the game consoles, the PS3, the PS2, the Xbox, and so on. But possibly a place for some of the richest user interface ideas is probably games. If you sit down and actually play console games or PC games or anything else, they often have a lot to say about creating interesting user interfaces and interesting looks and feels and, you know, doing something different. And taking some ideas that can brew in those kind of areas and merging them with something a little bit more conservative and generally usable rather than, you know, going with a particular theme, can make for some interesting user interfaces. But at the same time, you can't just go for a look and feel and not go, everyone is different. Just because I like this look and feel does not mean the next person next to me is going to like it. So every time you do something, you have to go and think, how can I do this and make it really flexible so someone can completely change it to have a completely different look and feel that they like? And that is one of the biggest challenges in creating something.
So you have to find the sweet spot between ease of use, you know, good looking look and feel to it, general accessibility, functionality.
And just being different. Yeah. Because you need to have some sort of unique, different identity of your own. If all you are is a, you know, knockoff of somebody else, be that a plain knockoff or a knockoff with you just change the color scheme, all you will be is, you know, the knockoff. If you have a look and feel of your own, then people will want you and your user interface and your software or your products for that particular look and feel, because that's what they're after and they found something different. The people who weren't going to buy an iPhone or whatever device anyway, they wanted something else.
The whole thing with the iPhone, it definitely has pushed things in the right direction with the smartphone. You know, people see what the possibilities are. But, you know, as a typical Apple product, it's closed and very controlled and what you can and can't do. You really can't do much outside of what they give you. And as far as, you know, a development kit, that, you know, they hear that it's supposedly going to be coming down the pipeline, whereas the OpenMocha project is a complete 180 of what the iPhone is. It's openness on every level. What are some challenges to being so open? I mean, it's going to slow down a process to a certain degree, correct?
The problems of being open are actually what you make closed. So at what point do you want to run an open project, an open product, an open company, but what bits do you create as part of the open project? And what parts do you go, well, look, this is some design and something that has to be done behind closed doors for the simple reason that the business has to, at the end of the day, you know, make revenue and make a profit and survive. And we can't do that by continually being completely open. So you do have to look at some things as, you know, there is no choice in this. We didn't open. We did this closed. But the result of what we do is open. If you didn't like our decision, you are able to change it yourself. But you may not have had an input to that decision, for example. So if it's as simple as, you know, we're deciding whether to make, you know, our, you know, default color scheme, you know, red and green or pink and purple or orange and black, and we decide to go to the community and go, hey, what color scheme do you want? That might not be something that is best done in the open fashion. It's a, well, here's our design, here's our color scheme, you may not like it, but over here is a way for you to completely change it. So the challenge is in what you do open and what you not do open, really. And there are a few lines which you probably can't cross there, especially when NDAs are involved with, like, certain hardware chipsets and so on. But even outside of that, you want to have some things that aren't done open. But the question is, what few things are they?
I guess looking at the Nokia project, it seems those guys have really fostered a community environment that's open to people, you know, creating their own applications. And it seems to be a very healthy ecosystem. I guess, you know, the OpenMocha project is definitely pushing in that direction, which is a good thing. You know, the more applications and the more different things, it's a positive step in the right direction. Where it seems where Apple is, you know, they're basically pushing everybody away and they're just taking in, you know, so many people that are, that they trust. You know, they raise the issue of, you know, trusted computing. Who can we trust to write applications, you know, so deep in the stack? Case in point, you know, Android, you know, the toolkit that Google's putting together for their phone platform doesn't really go that far down in the stack, it seems. What's your take on all that?
To some extent, Apple have a point. But at the same time, they're also wrong. In general, so how far do you trust somebody? If you want to have lots of third-party developers writing software, you can have lots of different levels of third-party developers. You can have the, I just started, you know, college and I learned to program last week and I'm going to write an application for my iPhone and, you know, get everybody to run it. And then everybody runs it. And if you have thousands of people like that, and I would say that if you learned to program last week and you write an application, the chances are it will have bugs and problems, or it may have major ones. And then your platform may start to get a reputation for being a platform on which all of the software is really horrid and nasty and, you know, you shouldn't get this device because it's bad. And that's not because of Apple, for example, did it. It's because a third-party developer did it, but the third party gave their product a bad name. So from that point of view, they do have a point. But the question is that an extreme position you want to take to limit everyone else out there and give them a barrier of entry to be able to develop anything for it just because of the bad eggs? Is it a question that consumers are too finicky or that they blame the messenger? That is a whole big question on its own. But I would say that, you know, Apple is probably barking up the wrong tree if they want to keep people out. Yeah, being inclusive is good, but giving people the ability to go, you know, you can write your application in whatever language you want, in whatever you want. You can release it any way you want, and that is your business. All we do is provide you with the ability to do that. From that point of view, OpenMoko is definitely going up the right path, which is being language agnostic. You don't have to write your programs in a given language, you know, like C or C++. You can write them in Python, you can write them in Perl, because the system can have anything put on it you want, and because it's freely extendable. Open is good because it breeds the ecosystem, but at the same time, within that ecosystem, you are going to have rotten eggs. The only thing at the end of the day is being able to know what is a bad piece of software and what will give you trouble and to avoid it, and what is a good piece of software and what you should definitely download and use and, you know, add to your device.
Yeah, I've been going through some of the OpenMoko community stuff, and it's really fantastic what's going on over there. To me, it's very exciting. I'm going to be doing some testing. Michael Shieler modified one of the phones to work with the 850 megahertz spectrum, which is used very commonly here in North America. So, you know, there was the whole issue that the phone's only a tri-band, so they're doing some testing with the possibility of releasing an 850 megahertz version for North America. So I'm eagerly awaiting to see one of the phones and actually play around with it for a bit. And I'm curious to see how it looks and how it functions. I know it's still in very early alpha/beta level right now. It's still only a development platform. But I played around with it a little bit inside of a virtual machine in QEMU, and it looks really fantastic. And I'm really excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, the screen on the OpenMoko phone, on the Neo 1973, is actually quite amazing. It's 285 dpi. The only problem with that is that in order to drive that many pixels requires a lot of grunt. And we really are pushing the CPU and the memory bus and everything else on there just to provide, you know, content for a screen of that resolution, which is a little bit of a challenge at the moment.
Well, hopefully it'll pay off. How difficult is it to port an application that's just a regular Linux desktop-type application to run in the OpenMoko? Looking at it and playing around with it in QAMU, it seems to be a pretty robust and full-featured Linux system.
Well, frankly, most of your effort will be trying to get your application to display in, like, at VGA or less resolution. That's really where most of your challenge is, if it's a GUI application. If it's not GUI, well, it should just work. There should be almost nothing you need to do. I have, for example, A17 is already ported. It runs on my Neo, and it actually didn't really take any work to port it. Most of the work was writing a little bitbake file to actually build the packages, which is the same packaging work required pretty much for any packaging system, whether it be for Debian or Red Hat or SUSE or whatever. So So it isn't actually that much work once you kind of, you know, get used to, you know, how, you know, the open embedded build system works that OpenMoko uses. It works reasonably well. So you're going to be spending the majority of your effort and time in cramming your user interface down into a tiny screen and to work with, well, basically a mouse that only has one mouse button, and you will only move around the screen when the mouse button is pressed. You can't use mouse over or hover, for example. You don't have a keyboard, so you will have to be able to survive without one. Or, you know, if you need key input, you'll have to realize that part of your screen is going to be eaten up by a virtual keyboard, so your application has to be able to shrink down to a much smaller size to allow room for that virtual keyboard. So, as I said, you know, it's all the work is in cramming your screen real estate down and still making the application, you know, usable at that size.
So it's all user interface, really, is where the challenge is.
Mostly, yeah.
Because looking at the specs of the OpenMoko on the Neo 1973, it seems to be a pretty powerful machine, especially the GTA 02 version that's going to be coming out in a few months.
Yes, actually, you'll find that I actually did some benchmarks, and the GTA 01 and 02 are about 1% to 2% of the speed of my 3 gigahertz Core 2 desktop machine. So it might seem that they're more powerful than they really are, that, you know, that 256 or 400 megahertz there looks like a reasonable amount, but remember, you have a slower memory bus, it is a different architecture. You won't get quite the speed you're after, but it is still not too bad overall.
Does that implement a full X11 for the graphics?
Yes.
It does?
Yes.
Because I know, like, for instance, I was reading up on the Qtopia port to the Neo 1973. They're writing directly to the frame buffer, correct?
Yes, Qtopia does not use X. So traditionally, the early Qtopias wrote only to the frame buffer, and that was it. They had dumb frame buffer support. Later on, they added acceleration support for particular chipsets, but Qtopia basically has to do its own acceleration architecture.
So there's pluses and minuses with each approach, then?
Yep.
If you do it directly to the frame buffer, it's less overhead, but it's not as portable, correct?
Well, actually, no, direct to the frame buffer is much more portable in that it'll work on everything because there is pretty much no graphics device that does not have a frame buffer. But it could be exceedingly slow. In order to get any form of speed, you have to then write specific drivers. In the case of the GTR1, I had already released near 1973, there is no graphics acceleration. The frame buffer is basically in memory, in normal system memory. So there is no way that you can really speed it up by, you know, graphics acceleration code because there is nothing to accelerate. It's dumb frame buffer, and that's as fast as anything will get. With the FreeRunner, which is not released yet, the graphics chip is actually an accelerated graphics chip, so the video memory is not in system memory. You have to access it just like a PC across a bus. And access to that memory across the bus is actually relatively slow compared to access to system memory. So writing a frame buffer driver basically means you're accessing your pixels across that bus all the time, and that's what makes it exceedingly slow. So they do have to do an accelerated driver to make it frame.
Let me ask you, with the new version that's coming out, how much more advanced are the graphics going to be compared to what we've seen?
All right. Technically, on paper, it is much more advanced. In practice, what you gain on the swings, you lose in the roundabout. We have a fairly slow bus to the video card. On the video card, we have accelerated, we have lots of accelerated features that are able to be accelerated. It's even got 3D, it's OpenGL ES compliant, but we won't have any OpenGL drivers for a simple reason: it's going to take too long to write them, and there are other limitations that are going to make them less useful than in theory it might look. So, for example, the 3D chipset can only display 511 by 511 as the 3D buffer size, and our screen is VGA, 640 by 480. So you can't even do full-screen 3D. And that, along with a few other things, has put OpenGL on the back burner, i.e. on the very end of the list of things. So other than that, we would have 2D acceleration, which means blips, i.e. copies of off-screen, on-screen, actually have off-screen video memory fills. You should have basic, you know, font masking, rendering support, and so on. So basic 2DX should be fine. With XRender, all the alpha blending 2D stuff, unfortunately, the chip can't accelerate most of XRender. It can only accelerate some parts of it, which is a major problem because when you have a slave pipeline and you have to fall back to software, you then have to start reading your pixels from the frame buffer, doing it with the CPU and writing them back. The moment you have to do that when rendering, you may as well not be using graphics acceleration because it would be faster to do it with the CPU and system memory to start with. So to some extent, we have gained with things like acceleration for the basic 2D stuff that can be done asynchronously to the CPU doing something else. But we've lost on the other ends by either having to fall back to software rendering, which will be a major loss compared to doing software rendering in system memory, or not having the acceleration at all, or having to send graphics data across the fairly slow bus to video memory.
So it poses different challenges, even though it's supposed to be a little more advanced than the older version.
Yeah, yeah. It's give or take, it will be about the same. And I've actually done benchmarks, and my benchmarks show that to the give or take about that case. That, you know, you gain a bit, a little bit here, and then you lose something somewhere else.
So if I want to program some applications for the OpenMocha project, what are the basic tool sets that I should be learning? Obviously, you should C, correct? Because that's your background.
Well, okay, so my background would be, well, C, or C or C++. But to start with, what you want to do is you want to get an open embedded or an open loco build tree so you can build the distribution. That generally involves you have to build everything, including the kernel, so it takes a while and eats up a fair bit of several gigabytes of disk space. But once you have that, you're able to rebuild the entire operating system and all packages. Then what you'll need to do is you'll need to basically create a really simple program like Hello World in C or whatever it is, and then build a bitbake or .bb file for it. There's tutorials on the openmoco.org wiki on how to do this, and that basically will get you building your own piece of software as a package, which then you can copy onto the device, say, you know, SSH in and SCP it in and, you know, IPKG install, and that will then install your software and you can then run it. From there, you would then want to start making more complicated software, something that can actually display a window, for example, pop up a screen and that you can interact with. From there on, once you can actually build for OpenMocha, and if you add any requirements for libraries, like you want to use CTK, which or ships on the device by default, for example, that your build would link with GTK, and so on. Once you have all of that settled, then it's all a question of writing your code to the device. You don't even have to develop on the device. You can develop on your desktop and just pop up a window on your standard Linux desktop. So development can actually be surprisingly easy from that point of view. It's just getting yourself started is a little bit of work. After that, it all just, you know, rolls along without much incident.
It's great stuff. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, Karsten. I wish you all the best. I wish you all the best of luck with the Enlightenment project and all the best with your work with the OpenMocha project. Thanks and take care.
Okay. Yep. Thank you very much. And thanks for calling me. I was glad to be here.
I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
All right.
Have a good day.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
All right. Okay. Bye.
Wow. Hello, everybody. This is podcast number 12.
Oh. Yeah. Whoops.
What the hell is that?
It was, I just
it was
popped
podcast
on my GPU.
Number 12.
It was podcast number 12. I think that was Going Linux podcast, maybe. No, let me double check. I have to go look at my list of podcasts.
That's a great name for the show, podcast number 12.
Is that one of those shows where, like, the episodes are named episode 1, episode 2, episode 3?
Oh, I'll tell you, hold on.
We name our episodes that.
No.
Yeah, but we have a naming convention.
You know what? Thank you for reminding me, because I've added a handful of new shows, and I tell you again, I emphasize and I strongly encourage and plead for you people out there who are producing shows to your file names of your shows, put your show name in the file name. Don't just label it like episode whatever or the number of the show, because I got a whole bunch that say episode whatever and then... and then I got a whole bunch that just have like 201, 202, 203, 204. And it just kills me. I have no idea what it is.
Is anybody else up to 204?
Somebody is, but I don't know who it is because I didn't listen to their show because all I have is a file number. I don't know who it is.
Yeah, that could be a little annoying.
Well, it's got to be one of these that I recently added.
You added a whole bunch recently, didn't you?
Yeah. Let me look at some of these feeds.
I haven't got around to actually listening to all those new shows.
That was Linux Crazy. Linux Crazy, I don't understand their naming convention at Linux Crazy because some shows are numbered, but, you know, there's one that's like Fun with GIMP and it's called GIMP.org. Then there's one that's little this and little that much of that is 7.org. Then asterisk is asterisk.org. Then Vostro is Vostro.org. Then a Linux Journey is 10.org. And now an asterisk answer machine is wild2.org, which I don't understand the naming. It's a great show. I like the content of all these shows. I just, please, spare me the trouble of trying to figure out what is what and give me, like, meaningful show names so I know. I don't know. Maybe it's just a Bash Potter thing. Maybe everybody else...
Stop your whining, Dan.
I'm sorry. Let me look at the source here of these shows. Dun, dun, dun. I don't know. To hell with it.
To hell with you all.
To hell with you all. Yes. But there are good shows, though. Good shows.
The more the merrier.
Yes. Good interview, Pat.
Thank you. I wish you guys could have participated.
So do I. But, you know, my wife was sick. Alan was a dick. What are you going to do?
No, I was just sick.
Pat didn't tell us till the 5 minutes after the interview started.
Yeah, right. We actually got a couple of nice emails.
We
got a very nice email from Ryan Gilley.
Oh!
Yeah, you didn't see that one? It was dated February 2nd?
If it's the one I think it is.
Yeah, I'm not going to read the whole thing back, but one of the things that jumped out at me, he goes, at the end of the day, I want to hear a bunch of guys that just shoot your shit.
And we do that well.
Yep. So, Ryan, thanks for the nice email. We appreciate it.
Yeah, Ryan Gilley, it's about his opinion.
Thank you.
And the Linux format review. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. That was very nice. You know what? People, send us email, please. If you have questions, we will answer them on the show as well as in email. If you have complaints, we will talk about it.
Or we'll at least try.
Yeah, if you have complaints, we'll talk about it on the show. If you are satisfied...
And forward them the link.
Yeah. If you have any problems with what you hear on the show, address your complaints to link@thelinuxlink.net. All other inquiries, just send it to techshow@thelinuxlink.net. If you really can't remember link@thelinuxlink.net, you can send us the hate mail and we'll forward it to Link. He gets it. So, you know.
He does enjoy reading it.
Yes, and we enjoy reading it too.
We also got today we got an email from EG. He had a couple of questions regarding our Acer set up with Trixbox. He was wondering if we needed to get a card from Digium to do phone conferencing. And the answer is no. You don't need any specialized hardware to set up a phone conference in Acer.
Keep talking so I can grab my laptop.
Okay. And he had a second question regarding NotMyth. He was having some problems with the distribution recognizing his drives. And
that sounds like he may have a bad CD.
Hardware issue, right? Yeah.
It's either bad, because I had this once, too, on it. It was actually the DVD. It looked like it was good, but it just didn't burn properly. And I would try another. I'd try burning another DVD.
Yeah.
That's the release I have on there now. And that went in, I mean,
with the hardware that he's got, I got pretty much all the same stuff, and it recognized everything for me.
Yeah, Nomath is basically Debian with, you know, all the BitTV stuff set up, you know,
yeah.
A bunch of install scripts. And it works pretty well, but the times I've tried it, it seems pretty good. Currently, my MythBox, I'm running MythBuntu, which is based on Ubuntu. That works pretty well. And there's also MythDora. So if he's continuously having problems with NotMyth and he tries, you know, reburning a disk, he's still having problems and it's not a hardware issue, maybe he should try a different distribution that has MythTV on it. You could try one of those, too.
Yeah, because I think it's, you know, like I said, I think it's either a bad install disk or it could be a CD drive that's going bad.
Right.
Install drive on it. Because I know I lost the DVD in my desktop machine. I lost the DVD burner portion of it. That, you know, after using it for a while, it would burn like one disk on it, and that would be it. You'd have to like let it rest for, you know, an hour, and then it would burn another disk. And, you know, you can get them now for like $30-$40.
Yeah, you could probably even get them even cheaper than that if you go like to one of
the
shows.
Oh, yeah, if you look, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah. Hardware crapping on you can be very frustrating. You think it's the OS, and it's not. You know, sometimes you have like a disk failure where you have sectors going bad on you, or memory starts to crap out on you. It can drive you insane.
Yeah, I got to take my desktop apart and get the memory checked in it. It's getting... Excuse me. I'm getting to the point where, like, you know, every like couple of hours, my machine just slows down. So, you know, especially if I have like Firefox or something open on it, the whole system just slows down. I close everything, log out, restart it, and it comes right back to life again. So, something is funky, and I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, my piece of shit laptop is starting to rear its ugly head again. I was playing around with it the other day. It started overheating and shutting off by itself. So.
I was going to say, it's still overheating.
Not a good thing. Well, the fan is definitely blowing. And I don't know, what was I compiling something? I mean, I think the compiling just freaking did it in. I booted it up today for a little bit and it seemed to be okay. It's blowing
like a can of air in there.
It's done. Yeah, I should try that.
Yeah, maybe there's something, you know, some dust is blocking it somewhere.
Blow it, Pat. Blow it.
Oh, you're good at that, Dan.
How's that feel?
Just put your lips together and blow.
You know what? I have not been proactive in looking this up, but because my wife's laptop is down, she's been using mine, and I typically, well, not a lot, but I used to leave my system on all the time. Logged in, I use GNOME on Ubuntu. It's running, what is it, Gutsy Gibbon. Runs great. Sometimes, now that my wife has been using it more than I have, I'll do the user switching, which works perfectly fine. I don't have a problem with that. But she prefers KDE. That's what she's accustomed to. And I noticed that when I have KDE running, my system is a lot hotter. Even when, you know, you close the lid and just put it off to the side, the system still runs like it doesn't. I don't know.
Maybe it's not throttling back the CPU.
I'm wondering why, but why would that be? Why would KDE prevent that, but GNOME it doesn't have that problem?
Because GNOME has CPU scaling.
It does?
I don't know. Maybe out of the box, you know, the Kubuntu doesn't have it by default.
But it's not Kubuntu; it's just Ubuntu. With KDE.
Oh, and you just installed KDE on top? I can't tell you that.
Yeah. I'll have to look into that.
Dan, I hope you've got a good recording for tonight, because Audacity just died on me.
I have a backup.
I got a backup, too.
Yeah. Okay.
What are you running on the Mac, Alan?
Tonight it was, yeah.
Good. I hope it takes your whole Mac out, too.
Yeah, Bastard. Sorry, it doesn't, though.
My Debian box here, it's my Debian box that I have the recording set up on, it's chugging away, no problems.
Yeah, you'll have these things every now and then. Close.
Shame, shame, shame.
That just means I can turn that computer off now.
Well, anything else? I see we have a song tonight, Pat.
Yeah. I got one of my old ones.
All full of self-promotion today, eh?
Yep, you got it.
All right.
I figured people have been asking me. I haven't played one of them in a long time.
I was thinking about that a couple weeks ago, but then I'm like, yeah, it's Pat's band. Screw it.
Oh, no. This is from a long time. Yeah. This is from like 1992.
When in 1992, Alan was like 40 years old.
What'd you say?
I said 1992, Alan was 40 years old.
No, I was
35.
No, I wasn't that old. Old, but not that old.
You know what? Past couple weeks, we had a special guest on. Past couple weeks, we had a special guest on Link. And if you guys really enjoyed Link on the show, send us an email, and we'll see about getting him to come on more often.
We'll try to get him back on.
Maybe we'll make him a host of the show again.
That'd be nice.
Yeah.
That'd be cool if he can come on as a guest.
Yeah.
Special guest host, Link.
Yeah, it would be like Beverly. You remember, not Beverly Hills, Melrose Place. Like after when Heather Locklear joined.
Thank God I don't.
And every episode they had, and special guest star Heather Locklear, even though she like was on the show for three or four
like
seasons
years.
Or so. Yeah, she was on for like, but she was always labeled as a special guest star. So it'd be special guest star.
You get more money if you're labeled as a special guest star.
It was like the Love Boat. It's special guest star Charo.
Yeah, Charo.
Special guest star Charles Nelson Reilly.
Charo made a career out of like
Fantasy Island and the Love Boat.
And she was on the Gong Show a lot too, wasn't she?
I don't remember.
What, Charo?
Yeah.
Probably, yeah. I always love that clip they have of the two girls eating the ice pops. It's on YouTube for the Gong Show. It's a great clip.
Well,
you should look it up. It's very good.
Is her first name Peppa?
Who's that?
Charo.
I don't know. Good question. What her birth name is? Go look it up on Wikipedia.
Well, I'm looking it up on IMDb, but I don't.
Got to figure out how to spell Charo first.
Isn't it Charro?
I think so.
El Charo del Misterio. No, there's like a lot of Charos on here, but I don't know which one is her. Maybe she just has a web page. In Mexico, Charo is a term referring.
There it is. It's Charo.
Oh.
Her real name is Maria del Rosario Pilar Martinez Molina Baeza Rastin, born 1941, in Murcia, Spain.
Ah, there we go, Charo.
She was Xavier Cugat was her sugar daddy. She was 15. She was running around with that old guy. He was 66-year-old band leader at the time, and she was 15.
That's awesome. Well, I guess she...
There's a Gong Show clip.
She hasn't done a lot over the... I mean, she's done a handful of stuff, but she kind of had huge gaps in appearances.
She's getting up there in age, man. She was hot when she was younger.
I thought she was... Wait, it's not the same. I don't see any labeling about her being on the Gong Show. Maybe she wasn't.
She's pushing 70, man.
Well, she still looks pretty good for 70.
Yeah, I'm sure she's had some plastic surgery done.
Don't they all?
You know who had plastic surgery, man, and I was shocked how she looked?
Did she saw Dirty Dancing?
Which one?
Well, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about Basic Instinct 2. What's her name?
You mean Basic Instinct, Oh, man, what is her name?
She was in Total Recall. What's her name?
Total Recall. She's not Sharon Stone.
Sharon Stone. I could barely recognize her, man. She's had so much plastic surgery.
Another one that was like that was Jennifer Grey. She was in Dirty Dancing. She looks completely different now.
Well, she got a nose job, didn't she?
Yeah, now she looks completely different. She looks really good, but she looks completely
I don't think she's 50 years old.
Who, Jennifer Grey?
Yeah, I don't think so.
No,
I think Sharon Stone may be 50.
Yeah, Sharon Stone's a little older. I guess Ashley Simpson. Is that her name? Disney Channel chick.
I don't know. I don't watch that.
Not yet, huh? Kids aren't into the Disney.
I don't have any tweeners.
Oh, you wait, baby. You wait.
Hannah Montana.
Woo! No, not Ashley Simpson. Damn it.
Cheetah Girls. Dan watches all those shows.
You don't know the half of it, man. You don't know the half of it. I know she's on the Sweet Life with
Zach. He's got his tickets for Hannah Montana and everything.
No, but I know my youngest daughter wants to see it. My older daughter, no. She's kind of getting out of the Hannah Montana phase. But she's a liar, too, because I know she listens to the music, and I know she still watches Hannah Montana. And I know she's lying. Man, what's her name? Oh,
right.
Tisdale. Is it Ashley Tisdale?
I have no idea.
Ashley Tisdale, not Ashley Simpson. Ashley Tisdale. That's right. She got plastic surgery done or a nose job or something. Now she looks completely different. I don't know.
Dan, you're gonna get some work done?
I'm gonna get implants and I was thinking about getting something done with my butt. I don't know what yet.
Butt cheek lift?
Yeah, maybe that. Maybe they can install a
muffler.
They get a filtration system. That would be nice.
I was gonna say a carbon filter.
It's something I just have to, you know.
Dan with a carbon fiber butt.
Go watch Jackass 2.
Oh, why?
They have a gas mask. That's connected to Guy Duran. The guy starts throwing up.
That's horrible.
It was awful.
All right, I guess we better play a song.
Wrap up the show.
Wrap it up, B. All right. This is Stormy Sea by Hadrian's Wall. Pat, what are you playing on this? Bass?
Oh, the bass.
No vocals?
No.
All right.
Thanks
everybody.
For listening, everybody.
Yes, thank you.
Yes. Gordon Krupert from Gumsticks is our guest next week.
Excellent.
And hopefully Link can make a guest appearance.
Yes, that'd be nice.
And remember to write in and ask about Pat's Magic Sauce.
Yes, Pat's Magic Sauce. And don't forget
Secret Sauce.
Scale this weekend.
Yes, if you're in the Southern California area, please go.
Linux Expo. All right, everybody, here it is, what you've been waiting for, Stormy Sea by Hadrian's Wall.
Good night.
Swirling mass of
By now, you've probably heard about Linux, but whether you're a pro or have barely heard the word, Scale. The Southern California Linux Expo has something for you. Scale 6X will have over 50 speakers covering the hottest topics in open source software and more than 75 booths this year representing a wide range of commercial products and nonprofit organizations. Don't forget Friday's special sessions with Docs, open source software in the healthcare industry, the Women in Open Source Conference, and new this year is the Open Source Software in Education Conference. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2008 at the Westin LAX Hotel in Los Angeles, California. For more information and to register for the expo, visit socallinuxexpo.org. Use promo code CAST, that's C-A-S-T, for 40% off of your registration. We'll see you at Scale.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush.
Shut up.
Just shut up.
It's over.
It's over.
It's always over.
It's over, Johnny.
And with that...
Time to go.